Ever feel like your brain is this giant, mysterious puzzle?
Me too, honestly. We've been getting lost in a mountain of neuroscience articles and research, especially about memory, and I'm so ready to unpack it all.
What always gets me about memory is it's not just remembering facts and figures. It's really at the core of who we are, how we learn, how we experience the world.
It's true. Like, it's the operating system we never even think about until... while it crashes. So before we get too far, let's talk about the basics we always hear about short-term versus long-term memory. But your research had a really cool way of explaining it, like a computer almost.
Oh, it's such a good analogy. Think about short-term memory. Like your computer's RAM, it's limited, right? It holds what you need in this moment. So that phone number you're trying to remember while scrambling for your phone, that's short-term memory. But long-term memory, that's your hard drive. Vast storage for all that information from like those childhood memories to what you had for dinner last night. Oh, so that catchy song lyric from like 5 years ago that's safely stored away on the hard drive? I like the sound of that. But hold on, it gets even more interesting. Your research also mentioned different types of memory, not just how long we remember something.
Exactly. You've got declarative memory. Think facts, events, clear memories. That's how you ace that history test, remembering all those dates and names.
If only my history tests were that easy. Okay, so declarative memory, that's like stuff we know. What about the stuff we don't even realize we remember?
Ah, you're talking about non-declarative memory. It's less conscious, harder to explain. Mm-hmm. Think riding a bike, you don't think about every pedal stroke, you just do it. And that's non-declarative memory.
Muscle memory. Yeah. Once you've got it, you've got it. So if I'm tackling something new, like say I'm finally going to learn piano, are different parts of my brain handling these different types of memory?
You bet. Imagine the hippocampus, crucial for declarative memory, as your brain's librarian organizing and storing those facts and events. But your piano skills, those non-declarative memories, that's more the basal ganglia and the cerebellum, which are all about movement and coordination.
It's like having a whole orchestra in there playing different tunes. Okay, that makes so much sense. But we've got these amazing storage systems, yet sometimes things go missing. What's the deal with forgetting those, wait, what was I saying? Moments. We've all been there.
That's where forgetting comes in. And get this, your research highlighted three types: passive obsolescence, targeted forgetting, and motivated forgetting. Passive obsolescence is like that shirt you totally forgot was at the back of your closet. Out of sight, out of mind.
Use it or lose it, as they say. Okay, targeted forgetting. That sounds a little intense, like my brain has a mind of its own.
It is wild. Think of it like your brain's doing a nightly cleanup. It sorts through memories while you sleep, deciding what to keep, what to toss. It's actually consolidating those memories.
Wow, my brain's more organized than I am. So if I can't remember something, does that mean my brain just decided it wasn't important enough?
Not always. We've also got motivated forgetting. This is when we're actively trying to suppress those not-so-fun memories. Research even suggests that the prefrontal cortex, your brain's command center, might be involved in hitting that delete button.
I'll have to remember that next time I trip in public. But let's be real, sometimes that mental delete button doesn't work so well, does it?
True. Which leads to a biggie memory's fallibility. You had that case about Titus, a man wrongly convicted based on faulty eyewitness testimony. It's scary how our memories aren't always accurate.
It really makes you think our memories, they're actually quite fragile. Stress, emotions, even things we encounter after an event, it can all change them.
It's true. Memories aren't like photographs. They're more like stories we keep telling ourselves. And each time, the story might change a bit without us even realizing it. We layer in new info, our current feelings. It's fascinating.
Okay, that's both terrifying and really cool. So if our memories are that flexible, is there a way to make them more reliable?
This is where your brain's incredible plasticity comes in. It's not static. It's constantly rewiring itself based on what we do, what we experience.
So our brains are always under construction. That's actually a really exciting concept.
Imagine it like this. You've got these tiny connections between brain cells, the synapses, right? Think of them as pathways in a forest. Walk a path often enough, it becomes more defined, easier to travel. Neuroplasticity is basically your brain making new paths or paving old ones based on your experiences.
Ah, so the more we use certain pathways, the stronger those connections get. That explains why practicing something is so crucial for learning.
Right. Every time you're practicing, whether it's a new language, a skill, or even just a new way of thinking, you're strengthening specific pathways in your brain, making them faster, more efficient.
It all comes back to practice. You mentioned London taxi drivers before, and that study about them always fascinates me. They have to memorize that entire city layout, which is just incredible.
and their brains actually change because of it. They did studies, and London taxi drivers, they have a larger hippocampus, especially the areas dealing with spatial memory compared to people who don't drive taxis.
No way! So their brains physically grew and adapted based on their job. That's wild. This whole neuroplasticity thing is amazing, but it also makes you wonder, if our brains are so adaptable, why is it sometimes harder to remember things as we age?
That's the million-dollar question. Scientists are still unraveling all the complexities, but a few things seem to be at play. As we age, our brains naturally produce less of certain chemicals, like acetylcholine, which is crucial for memory.
So it's like the signal's not as strong as it used to be.
A good way to put it. Also, neurogenesis, that's the formation of new brain cells, it slows down as we age. And then there's synaptic pruning, where the brain cleans up those weaker connections to make things more efficient.
Okay, so things are slowing down a bit, but this pruning thing, I thought that was just a kid thing. It keeps happening.
It's most active during childhood, but research suggests it keeps going throughout life, maybe not as intensely. It's all about fine-tuning those brain circuits based on our experiences.
So even as adults, our brains are constantly adapting and changing, which is why it's so important to keep learning new things, keep those challenges coming.
Absolutely. Your brain craves novelty. Learning, challenging yourself mentally, staying socially connected, it's all fuel for a healthy brain.
This is all so fascinating. Different types of memory, how forgetting works, how our memories can be flawed, and this incredible ability for our brains to change. Okay, let's get practical for a second. Are there techniques to actually improve our memories?
You're in luck. We found a ton of really effective techniques that actually work with your brain's natural learning process. One that always comes up is spaced repetition.
Ah, yes. Instead of cramming, you space out your study sessions over time. Classic.
There's a reason it's a classic. Spaced repetition takes advantage of how our brains solidify memories over time. So you review the material at longer and longer intervals, giving your brain a chance to strengthen those connections.
So if I'm learning a new language, I shouldn't cram all the vocabulary at once. I should review it regularly, but with breaks in between.
You got it. That spacing effect gives those memories a chance to become more permanent. It's so much better than cramming.
Noted. Now, what about this interleaving practice? That's a new one.
This one is super effective. Instead of focusing on one thing for ages, you mix it up during your study session.
So, for my new language, I might switch back and forth between vocabulary and grammar instead of spending an hour on each separately.
Exactly. It keeps your brain on its toes, constantly having to retrieve different types of information, making the learning more challenging, but way more effective.
No pain, no gain, right? In a brain-boosting kind of way. Spaced repetition, interleaving. What else should we add to our memory toolkit?
This one is often overlooked. Elaborative rehearsal. It's about actively making connections, linking that new information to things you already know.
So instead of just passively reading or listening, I should be trying to relate the information back to my own experiences, right?
Exactly. Engage those senses. If you can create a story, visualize it, connect it to your own life, it'll become so much more memorable.
It's like giving those memories extra hooks to hold on to, which actually reminds me, my research also mentioned something about teaching others to solidify learning.
Absolutely. When you teach something, you have to organize the information, recall it clearly, and explain it. And all of that supercharges your own understanding.
That's so true. I've noticed that myself. Explaining a concept to someone else always helps me understand it way better. Okay, we've got spaced repetition, interleaving, elaborative rehearsal, teaching others. Anything else? This is like brain training gold.
There's one more technique that's really cool, especially since you're so interested in how the brain navigates. It's about using your brain's natural navigation system to your advantage.
Wait, my brain has a built-in GPS. Tell me more.
It's true. Research shows we have specialized cells called place cells and grid cells that help us navigate and form those spatial memories. It's how you can walk around your own house in the dark without bumping into things.
My brain has a mental map of my house. That's incredible. But how does that help me remember, like, a grocery list?
Think memory palace. It's an ancient technique where you create a mental image of a familiar place and your house is perfect. Then you link the information you want to remember with specific spots within that image.
So if I have a speech to memorize, I could mentally place different parts of it in different rooms of my house.
Exactly. By connecting the information to vivid spatial cues, you're tapping into those powerful spatial memory networks, making it much easier to recall.
That's so cool. Okay, so we've talked about different types of memory, how tricky they can be, and even some tools to make them stick. But there's one more thing that really caught my eye in the research. The Enneagram. What is it exactly, and why is it so important in the study of memory?
The Enneagram is like the holy grail of memory research. Think of it as the physical trace of a memory in the brain.
A fingerprint that a memory leaves behind. That's a beautiful way to put it.
It is. For decades, scientists have been on the hunt for these memory fingerprints, trying to understand where and how our brains physically store memories.
What makes it so hard to find? Is it like a tiny hidden file in the brain's control center?
It's even more complicated than that. You see, memories aren't stored in just one place. They're spread throughout different brain regions, depending on the type of memory, the senses involved, the emotions tied to them.
So more like a complex web of information than a single file, which, now that I think about it, makes a lot of sense. It explains why my brain feels so jumbled sometimes.
It's an intricate network, and that makes it incredibly tough to study individual engrams. But scientists are making amazing progress using all sorts of high-tech research techniques to understand how and where our memories are stored.
Okay, so what are they doing? What kinds of clues are they following to crack the Enneagram code?
Believe it or not, one study you found involved sea slugs.
Sea slugs, not what I would have expected.
They're actually perfect for studying memory at a cellular level because they have relatively simple nervous systems, and their neurons are quite large and easy to identify. In fact, one scientist, Eric Kandel, even won a Nobel Prize for his research with a type of sea slug called aplysia.
Wow, a Nobel Prize for studying sea slugs. That's amazing. But what exactly did they learn from these little creatures? It seems like a long way from the human brain.
Kandel discovered that when aplysia form a new memory, for example, associating a touch with a mild electric shock, it actually creates physical changes in their brains. The connections between their neurons, those synapses we talked about, actually get stronger.
Hold on. So learning actually changes the physical structure of the brain, even in something as simple as a sea slug. That's wild.
It is. And this process, called long-term potentiation, or LTP, is now considered a key mechanism in how our brains form memories, too. You know that feeling when something just clicks after you've been practicing it? That's LTP in action. Those synapses are strengthening, making those connections more permanent.
So every time we learn something new, we're basically rewiring our brains, creating new connections, and making existing ones stronger. It's amazing. But if it's happening at such a microscopic level, how can scientists even study this in humans? We can't exactly give people sea slug brains, can we?
Thankfully not. We now have incredible brain imaging technology like fMRI and EEG that can observe activity in the living brain. And these tools are giving us invaluable insights into how human memory works.
So they can actually see which parts of the brain light up when we're forming new memories? That's incredible.
Exactly. And by studying those patterns of brain activity, they've been able to identify specific brain regions that are associated with different types of memory. For example, the hippocampus is highly active when we're forming new memories. And it also seems to be involved in retrieving those memories later on.
So the hippocampus is like the grand central station of memory formation. Fascinating. But what about different types of memories? The hippocampus seems to be key for facts and events. But what about memories tied to emotions? Those always seem to stick with me, for better or for worse.
You're right. Emotional memories often involve a different brain area, the amygdala. It's responsible for processing emotions, especially fear and pleasure, and it basically tags those memories with emotional significance, making them more, well, memorable.
That explains why I still remember that embarrassing moment from middle school so vividly. So the hippocampus for facts, the amygdala for emotions. What about all those how-to memories, the skills and habits we pick up along the way?
Those often involve the basal ganglia, which is involved in motor control, learning new procedures, like that piano playing you're so determined to conquer. It's really amazing how these different parts of our brains, each with its own specialty, work together to create this intricate tapestry of memories that shapes who we are.
It really is like an orchestra with all those different instruments playing in harmony to create something beautiful and complex. But hold on a second. My research also mentioned something about inheriting memories, and I have to admit, that one sounds a little far-fetched to me. Is there any truth to that claim?
That's where things get really interesting. We usually think of inheritance in terms of physical traits passed down through our genes. But there's a growing body of evidence that suggests experiences, especially traumatic ones, might leave a different kind of mark on our DNA, something called epigenetic marks.
Epigenetic marks, is that like some sort of secret code embedded in our DNA?
Think of it this way. If your DNA is the hardware, epigenetic marks are like software that can influence how that hardware is used. These marks act like switches that can turn certain genes on or off without changing the underlying DNA sequence itself.
Okay, so our experiences can actually change how our genes are expressed, even if they don't change our actual DNA sequence. But how does this tie into inheriting memories?
Well, some scientists believe that traumatic experiences can create epigenetic changes that are then passed down to future generations. And these changes could potentially influence things like the offspring's stress response, or even make them more susceptible to certain mental health conditions.
So you're saying a traumatic event experienced by, say, a grandparent could potentially impact the biology of their grandchild. That's both fascinating and a little bit unsettling.
It's a very new area of study, so more research is definitely needed to fully understand how these transgenerational effects work. But it does raise some really profound questions about the legacy we pass on to future generations. And it challenges our traditional understanding of inheritance. It suggests that our experiences might have a far greater reach than we ever imagined, potentially shaping the lives of our descendants for generations to come.
Now that is a mind-blowing thought. It seems like every time we think we've got the brain figured out, we uncover another layer of complexity. And speaking of uncovering layers, let's talk about something else that's crucial for a healthy brain. Sleep. I'm always hearing how important sleep is for memory, but why? What's actually going on in our brains while we're catching those Z's?
Sleep is like the ultimate brain booster. It's essential for consolidating memories, for strengthening what we've learned, and even for clearing out toxins that can build up in the brain.
So my brain isn't just taking a break when I'm asleep. It's more like it's undergoing a nightly renovation project.
Exactly. During sleep, your brain cycles through different stages, each with its own unique function. One crucial stage for memory consolidation is slow-wave sleep, characterized by those slow, rhythmic brainwaves. During this stage, research suggests that the brain actually replays memories, strengthening those neural connections. It's like it's reviewing the day's highlight reel, making sure to solidify those important memories.
Wow, so when I don't get enough sleep, am I basically robbing my brain of this essential consolidation time? No wonder I feel so foggy when I'm sleep deprived.
Exactly. Sleep deprivation can have a huge impact on learning, memory, and even cognitive performance. It's like trying to run a marathon after pulling an all-nighter. Your body and brain simply aren't going to function at their best.
I'm already reaching for my sleep mask, so slow-wave sleep is important, but my research also mentioned REM sleep, the stage where we dream. Does that play a role in memory, too?
It seems so. REM sleep seems to be particularly important for consolidating those emotional memories and for things like procedural learning. It's like your brain is busy processing emotional experiences and fine-tuning those newly acquired skills, all while you're dreaming away.
That's incredible. Both slow-wave sleep and REM sleep are crucial for a healthy memory. It's amazing how our brains are working so hard behind the scenes, even when we're supposed to be resting. Okay, we've covered so much ground about memory. Its types, its quirks, how it can be influenced, and even how sleep plays a role. Okay, so before we dove into the incredible world of memory, we were talking about how our brains are constantly changing and adapting thanks to this amazing thing called neuroplasticity. It's like our brains are sculpted by our experiences, always evolving.
That's a great way to put it. Every new skill we learn, every memory we form, every habit we create, it all boils down to those tiny connections between our brain cells, the synapses constantly rewiring themselves in response to our experiences.
It's mind-blowing to think about, and it makes you wonder what's going on beneath the surface of our conscious awareness. Speaking of which, our last conversation left me thinking about the unconscious mind. It's like this whole other world inside our heads, silently influencing our thoughts and actions.
And it's a world that neuroscientists are increasingly fascinated by. It's like exploring a hidden continent within our own minds. One way they're doing that is through the study of priming.
Priming. That's where exposure to one thing can influence how we respond to something else, even if we don't consciously make the connection. It's like our brains are picking up on subtle cues without us even realizing it.
Exactly. It's like planting a seed in the unconscious mind that later influences our thoughts or behaviors. You mentioned a classic study where participants were shown words related to either elderly or neutral concepts.
And then they measured how long it took those participants to walk down a hallway.
That's right. And the results were fascinating. The participants who had been primed with words related to elderly actually walked more slowly, even though they weren't consciously thinking about being old or slow.
Wow, so just seeing those words, even briefly, had a measurable effect on their behavior. That's both amazing and a little bit creepy. It makes you wonder what other hidden influences are shaping our perceptions.
It really highlights just how much our unconscious minds are absorbing from our surroundings, constantly processing information below the level of our awareness. And those subtle influences can shape our thoughts and actions in ways we might never even realize.
That's a good reminder to be. I know what you mean. Sometimes my dreams are so bizarre, it's like my brain is creating its own movie genre. Do we know why we dream? Is there a purpose to all that nocturnal craziness?
While we don't have all the answers, neuroscientists are making progress using tools like EEG to observe brain activity during different sleep stages, particularly REM sleep, when most dreaming happens.
And what have they discovered? What's the buzz about REM sleep and dreams?
One theory is that dreams might actually play a role in memory consolidation, helping our brains process and integrate experiences from the day. Another theory is that dreams might serve as a sort of emotional playground, allowing us to work through feelings and anxieties in a safe, simulated environment.
So dreams could be like our brain's way of doing overnight therapy. I like that idea.
It's a fascinating possibility. And some researchers believe that dreams might even contribute to creativity and problem solving by helping our brains make new connections and come up with novel solutions.
I've definitely had those aha moments after waking up from a dream, like my brain had been working on a problem in the background and suddenly the solution became clear. It's like a sudden burst of insight delivered straight from the dream world.
It speaks to the incredible power and creativity of our unconscious minds, even when we're not consciously aware of their workings. Dreams offer a glimpse into those hidden processes, those nocturnal wanderings that might actually shape our waking lives in unexpected ways.
That's a really cool way to think about dreams, like secret messages from our unconscious. It makes you want to pay closer attention to what's happening in those dream worlds. Okay, we've gone deep on the unconscious mind and those enigmatic dreams. Let's circle back to neuroplasticity, because this concept just blows my mind. You're telling me our brains can actually rewire themselves.
It's true. Neuroplasticity is the brain's remarkable ability to change and adapt throughout our lives, constantly rewiring its circuitry in response to our experiences. It's what allows us to learn new things, form memories, recover from injuries, and even change our habits and behaviors.
So it's not just that our brains are malleable when we're young and then become fixed as we get older. They really can change throughout our lives.
Absolutely. Our brains are constantly evolving, even in adulthood.
Yeah.
Every time we learn something new, practice a skill, or even just think in a certain way, we're strengthening those specific neural pathways.
So it's like those pathways in a forest you mentioned earlier. The more you walk them, the clearer and more defined they become. And the ones you stop using, well, they might start to fade.
Exactly. It's a use it or lose it principle. The more we engage in certain activities or thoughts, the more we reinforce those specific neural pathways, making them more efficient and accessible.
That's why it's so important to keep learning and challenging ourselves throughout our lives, right?
Yeah.
It's like a workout for our brains, keeping them fit and adaptable.
We got it. Engaging in activities that stimulate your brain learning a new language, taking up a musical instrument, challenging yourself with puzzles and brain games, these all contribute to maintaining and even enhancing your brain's plasticity.
It's like those London taxi drivers we talked about earlier. Their brains literally change to accommodate their demanding work. So by challenging our brains, we can actually make them physically change and grow.
Precisely. And it's not just about learning new things. Even simple lifestyle changes can make a big difference. For example, physical exercise isn't just good for your body. It also boosts blood flow to the brain, reduces stress, and can even stimulate the production of new brain cells, particularly in the hippocampus, which is essential for memory.
So hitting the gym isn't just about those washboard abs. It's about building a better brain, too. I like it.
Exactly. And don't underestimate the power of a good night's sleep. Sleep is crucial for consolidating memories, clearing out toxins that can build up in the brain, and allowing your brain to rest and recharge.
It's like giving your brain a nightly spa treatment essential for optimal performance. So exercise, sleep, learning, those are all key ingredients for a brain-healthy lifestyle. Are there any other habits we should be adopting?
Absolutely. Another powerful tool for boosting neuroplasticity is mindfulness meditation. Taking time to quiet the mind, focus on the present moment, and practice non-judgmental awareness has been shown to have remarkable effects on the brain.
Meditation. I've heard of good things, but how does it actually change the brain?
Well, studies have shown that mindfulness meditation can increase gray matter density in areas of the brain related to attention, emotional regulation, and self-awareness. It can also help to reduce stress, which is known to have detrimental effects on brain health.
So meditation is like a mental workout, strengthening those key brain areas. It's like giving our brains a mental makeover. Sign me up.
It's a powerful practice with a growing body of scientific evidence to support its benefits for both mental and physical health.
Okay, so we've got learning new things, physical exercise, mindfulness meditation, all great ways to boost neuroplasticity and keep our brains sharp. What about those brain training apps and games? They're everywhere these days, promising to make us all cognitive superheroes. What's the verdict on those?
It's true. Brain training programs have exploded in popularity. And while they can provide some mental stimulation and might lead to modest improvements in specific cognitive tasks, it's important to be realistic about their limitations.
So they're not a magic bullet for boosting IQ or preventing cognitive decline?
Not exactly. The research on brain training programs is mixed, and there's no conclusive evidence that they can significantly enhance overall cognitive function or prevent age-related decline.
So it's back to the fundamentals, a healthy lifestyle, engaging activities, and challenging our brains in meaningful ways.
Exactly. The best way to support brain health is through a holistic approach that nurtures both your physical and mental well-being.
I love that a holistic approach to brain health. It makes perfect sense. After all, our brains aren't isolated organs. They're intricately connected to every aspect of our lives. We've been on quite a journey through the landscape of the brain, from the power of neuroplasticity to the mysteries of the unconscious mind. But your research also touched on something that feels straight out of a sci-fi movie. Cognitive enhancement. We're talking smart drugs, brain stimulation, the whole shebang. Is it really possible to boost our brain power beyond its natural limits?
It's a question that's captivated scientists, ethicists, and anyone who's ever wished for a sharper mind or a better memory. The idea of unlocking our brain's full potential, pushing past those perceived limitations, it's incredibly alluring.
It's like the ultimate upgrade. Who wouldn't want to be able to learn faster, remember more, or tap into a higher level of creativity? But this is where things get a little tricky, right? Ethically, I mean. Where do we draw the line between enhancing our abilities and, well, becoming something other than human?
It's a complex issue with no easy answers. As with any powerful technology, there are both potential benefits and risks to consider. We have to tread carefully when it comes to manipulating the very essence of who we are. Our minds.
Okay, let's start with those smart drugs we hear about. What exactly are they, and do they really live up to the hype?
Smart drugs, or nootropics, run the gamut from prescription medications to over-the-counter supplements. They all claim to improve cognitive function, memory, focus, motivation, you name it. But the science behind them is mixed, to say the least.
So some are legit, others are snake oil. What's the deal with the prescription nootropics? Those seem like they might have more research behind them.
Take modafinil, for example. It's a medication that is prescribed for narcolepsy and other sleep disorders. It's thought to work by increasing dopamine levels in the brain, which can enhance alertness, focus, and motivation.
So it's like being super caffeinated, but with a prescription. Tempting, but no thanks. I need my sleep. But seriously, are there downsides to these prescription nootropics?
While modafinil can be effective for some people, it's important to remember it's a powerful medication with potential side effects. We're talking insomnia, anxiety, and even addiction. It's not a risk-free cognitive shortcut, that's for sure.
Okay, so maybe proceed with caution on the prescription stuff. What about all those brain-boosting supplements I see advertised everywhere? Are any of those actually worth my money?
Honestly, the supplement industry is like the Wild West of cognitive enhancement. Lots of big claims, very little scientific evidence. It's always best to be wary of products promising quick fixes or miracle results.
Buyer beware. So it sounds like sticking with what we know works is a good bet. A healthy lifestyle, good sleep, and all those brain-boosting habits we talked about. But wait a minute. You mentioned brain stimulation techniques earlier. Those sound even more sci-fi than smart drugs. What's that all about?
Brain stimulation techniques use electrical or magnetic pulses to directly modulate brain activity. One technique you mentioned is transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS.
TMS, that's the one where they use a magnetic coil to stimulate specific parts of the brain, right? I thought that was still pretty experimental.
TMS is actually FDA approved for treating conditions like depression and migraines. And while it's still early days, researchers are exploring its potential for enhancing cognitive function in healthy individuals too.
So they're essentially giving your brain a tune-up with magnets. It's like a high-tech brain massage. What kinds of results are they seeing?
There have been some really intriguing studies suggesting that TMS might be able to enhance things like memory, attention, and even creativity. But more research is needed to really nail down those long-term effects and potential risks. It's still a pretty new frontier.
Right, because tinkering with the brain's electrical activity is not something to take lightly. Are there any risks with TMS?
When administered by trained professionals, TMS is generally considered safe. But as with any medical procedure, it does carry some risks. We're talking potential side effects like headaches, muscle twitches, and in rare cases, even seizures. It's not something to jump into without careful consideration.
So there's a lot of potential, but also potential risks. That makes sense. But even beyond the science, I think cognitive enhancement raises some big ethical questions. Like, if we start enhancing our brains, are we still truly ourselves?
Now you're getting into some deep philosophical waters. That's a question that philosophers have been wrestling with for centuries. And now, with these new technologies emerging, it's becoming a very real question. If we can enhance our cognitive abilities, does that fundamentally change who we are at our core?
It's like that thought experiment, the ship of Theseus. If you gradually replace every part of a ship, is it still the same ship? Hmm. And if we start enhancing our brains piece by piece, are we still the same person? It's a brain twister for sure.
It really is a fascinating philosophical dilemma.
Hmm.
And there are no easy answers. And then cognitive enhancement also brings up concerns about fairness and equity. If these technologies become more readily available, will everyone have access to them? Or will they create a new divide between the haves and the have-nots? Something to think about.
It's like a real-life episode of Black Mirror. We could end up with a society where some people have a cognitive edge while others are left behind. Not exactly a future I'm eager to sign up for.
It's definitely something to be mindful of as these technologies continue to develop. It's crucial to have these conversations to really think about the potential impact of cognitive enhancement on both individuals and society as a whole.
Absolutely. We need to be mindful of the ethical implications as we explore these new frontiers of the brain. It's been an incredible journey exploring the amazing capabilities, complexities, and incredible potential of the human brain. Any final thoughts before we wrap up our deep dive?
Your brain is this incredible organ capable of learning, adapting, and evolving throughout your life. Embrace its complexities, nurture its well-being, and never stop exploring its extraordinary potential.
I love that. Embrace the mystery, nurture your mind, and never stop exploring. That's a wrap on our deep dive into neuroscience. We hope you've enjoyed this journey into the amazing world of the brain.